Hi, just a quick note before the episode starts. This episode is a continuation of our previous Tangent episode where we interviewed indie filmmaker Dylan Arrington about his history and experiences trying to make it in the film industry. Since this episode was taken from a longer interview, some parts, especially the intro and the outro, are a little abrupt in the editing. If you would like to watch the first part of this episode, it was our previous Tangent episode called Tales from the Set with an Indie Filmmaker, which can be found wherever you're listening to this episode. There is also no story time segment to this episode, so if you're listening on an audio platform like Spotify, we will now go to sponsor break. But if you're watching on YouTube, enjoy the episode. Number 10 on my list, I have Zodiac, directed by David Fincher. The screenplay is written by James Vanderbilt, and it's based off of the 1986 novel by Robert Graysmith. I saw this movie. On this list, this is the most current movie, like modern film I chose. All the movies I chose are pretty old. But I think that this is like the perfect suspense type thriller based on a true story. I've never seen something that was real that kept me on the edge of my seat the whole time. It really utilizes like the parts in like Alien and Jaws where they don't show the alien or the shark very much. Like in this movie, it does not show the Zodiac killer very much and focuses more on the psychology and actions of the people surrounding the cases and the protagonist, Jake Gyllenhaal. It's really, yeah, like I said, one of the only movies based on a true story that I really love. I think it's one of Jake Gyllenhaal's best performances. Putting the perspective of the story of the Zodiac killer behind a cartoon artist working for a newspaper who becomes obsessed with solving the case was just the coolest way to tell that story possible, rather than, you know, just the Zodiac being the protagonist. Yeah, like I said, I really think this film builds suspense better than any other thriller that I've seen. Particularly, this is my favorite scene. I talk in each of these movies about some of my favorite scene, but my favorite scene in this movie is, have you guys seen this movie, by the way?
Yeah, I love
this. I have not.
Okay. This doesn't spoil very much in case you watch it. Okay, yeah, I really recommend it. So there's the scene that really cemented this to make me put this on this list was the scene where Jake Gyllenhaal is confronting the poster in the guy's house at the end of the movie. It's one of the most chilling scenes I think I've ever seen in a movie, because there's no jump scares or loud cues that something terrible is about to happen. It's just pure, like, isolated terror. Yeah, so when Jake Gyllenhaal's performance, when the man tells him that he drew the poster and asks him to accompany him in the basement to find out what year the movie was shown, it's just, like, pure terror. And it's his face, it's imprinted in my mind. It's so, you feel so scared for him. And the music is incredibly subtle. Like, you can barely hear, like, maybe, like, a synth or a violin and like, the rickety sounds of, like, the house and echoed footsteps of the basement. The scene still leaves it up in the air whether or not that guy was the actual Zodiac killer or not, but it's just really one of the most tense movies I think I've ever seen. So that's my number 10, and I really recommend it. Do we go on to my number 9?
Yeah, feel free.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so my number 9 choice is a movie called Vampire's Kiss. Have you guys ever heard of this movie?
Now, this is Nick Cage's movie, right?
This is a Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of all the movies on this list, I really want you guys to watch this movie. Out of all the ones I'm talking about, this is it's an enigma, truly. It is a brilliant, a secretly brilliant film. When I first found out about this movie, it was put on this on like a worst movies of all time list. So I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be something that I can make fun of. And I know it's no secret that like people really hate Nicolas Cage as an actor, which I think is absurd. I think Nicolas Cage, like, seriously is one of the greatest actors ever. He pulls from this, like, old style of cinema from, like, the 20s and 30s and tries to incorporate it in a more modern way. I mean, I'll admit, he does do some stinkers. He has done some really bad ones recently. But
he needs to pay off his mortgage every now and then.
Yeah, exactly. So I found it really interesting when I watched this that it's labeled as a black comedy. It's directed by this guy named Robert Bierman and written by a guy named Joseph Minion. I don't know anything else they've done, but this movie really blew me away. because I was expecting it to be horrible. And now that I know that it's funny, it's supposed to be comedic, it's brilliant. I mean, it's one of the funniest and most brilliant films I've ever seen. So I'll describe this, the synopsis of it briefly. So the movie centers on Nicolas Cage as a literary agent / businessman who slowly delves into just outright insanity. Early in the film, he has a one night stand with this vampire mistress who bites his neck, and he's determined that he's becoming a vampire from it. I mean, just those two sentences alone, I'm immediately interested in this story. That is so weird and unique. And the film does a remarkable job of displaying his descent into madness. I really cannot think of another actor who just goes all out insanity other than Nicolas Cage. I mean, it is kind of funny when he does it, but it's entertaining, and I think he does a good job, and he certainly does a great job in this movie. Yeah, I mean, it does a great job of showing him going insane. He frequently visits a psychiatrist throughout the movie. He's imagining things, tearing up his apartment, and probably the most famous scene in the movie, in a fit of rage with his psychiatrist, he recites the entire alphabet. And when I saw that, I was like, this is the best acting I've ever seen. If you literally can recite the entire alphabet, you've won at acting. That's incredible. So, but the majority of the movie focuses on him obsessing over this missing file that he believes has been misplaced by this secretary named Alva. And all while this is all happening, he's convinced that he's becoming a vampire. I mean, it's crazy that someone even came up with this, but it's done. It's so chaotic. It's great. Like I said, he has said before that this was his favorite film that he worked on, and it certainly shows. I have a few facts over here about the movie that I thought were really interesting. Yeah, like I said, his main influence on the film was Charlie Chaplin and Dr. Oligarchy and Nosferatu, and it really shows in the movie. The film was extremely low budget, so a lot of the scenes where Nicolas Cage is a bloody mess, stumbling around the streets of New York, begging for pedestrians to kill him with a wooden stake, we're not staged. He almost gets hit by a car several times. He just stumbles across the road. He almost gets hit by a car several times. And he eats a live cockroach in the film, which he insisted that should be done. He said that I want to eat a cockroach. And I guess they messed up the take, so he ended up having to do it three times. So he ate three cockroaches. And I guess the last little bit factor about the movie I thought was really interesting was Christian Bale used Nicolas Cage's performance in this for inspiration for American Psycho. And I totally see it now, because those movies are incredibly similar. Just one's way funnier than the other, obviously.
Wow. Yeah, because I love American Psycho, so I didn't realize they were so similar like that.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you about two great scenes in this movie. I hope that these will sell you on watching this. So there's a scene kind of midway through the movie where he starts thinking he's becoming a vampire. And he's in the bathroom of his workplace, and he looks up at the mirror, and he claims he can't see himself. He's like, "Oh Christ, where am I? I don't know where I am. I've become one. I've become a vampire." And he talks in this weird accent throughout the movie too. I didn't talk about that. He said it's like a New York businessman accent. But anyway, so he's doing that, and he looks over to to another mirror to his right, and he's like, "Oh God, where am I?" And it cuts to this guy taking a crap under in the stall. You see his feet, and the camera lingers on his feet, and he's like, "Hey, can you quit all that sissy stuff? I'm trying to use the bathroom. Go to the ladies' room or something like that." It's hilarious, man. Like I said, he just randomly, they'll film him randomly going up to pedestrians. And there's these people going into a church, and it looks like it's Latvian Orthodox or something. They definitely do not speak English in the movie. So Nicolas Cage, they're walking up the steps, and Nicolas Cage runs up to all of them. He's like, "Put the cross up for me, the crucifix, show me. Me, vampire, Nosferatu, you idiot." And this guy's like, "What is this guy even saying?" And people are so confused. And then the church bells start ringing. He's like, "Oh Christ, the tortures of the damned." It's remarkable. It is a remarkable film. I would be really interested to see what Tyler thinks of it, because I know he and I like very similar style, themed movies, but I feel like that's out of his comfort zone. I'd really like to see what you'd think about that movie. But yeah, yeah,
I might watch it and let you know.
Yeah, it's very entertaining. Okay, so number eight on my list is Clockwork Orange, written and directed by Stanley Kubrick, based off the novel by Anthony Burgess.
Yeah,
Kubrick is one of the first directors I remember where I was just blown away by his work and became obsessed with him watching all of his films. He has such a unique style filming, especially shot style. The cinematography in all of his films is just breathtaking, really. But I really think this film is the most stylized of his previous works before and even after. The movie is incredibly vibrant in its cinematography. Every color pops on the screen. There's all these crazy colors. And it really complements Kubrick's signature shot style called the one-point perspective shot. Do you guys know what that is?
I think I do, but explain it.
Okay, so the one-point perspective shot that he's known for, it really is a photography method. It's if you think of looking through a camera, you know, there's obviously like the rectangle of what's in focus. If you think of it like there's three imaginary vertical rectangles with like two imaginary lines on the left and right side of the camera. So the way that filmmaking is taught is that all the action in your scene or the actor is talking will be in those two imaginary lines. Kubrick doesn't really do that, and he puts everything directly in the middle of the shot. So have you guys ever seen any Wes Anderson films?
Yes.
Okay. So like Wes Anderson does the same thing. Yeah, he's very inspired by Kubrick, but whereas like he does it in kind of like a artsy, like comical way, Kubrick does it in this really creepy way to display like madness. So, you know, he does this a lot in A Clockwork Orange. He does it a lot in The Shining. He does it in Full Metal Jacket. I mean, he really does it in all of his movies. This centered shot where that's the focal point is the middle of the screen. And it really makes the shot look like a painting, really, to me. And I really like that. Like I said, he uses this a lot throughout the film to not only build up the dystopian world surrounding the characters of Britain, but also to convey the main characters' insanity. Do you guys know what the movie's about?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Do you know what it's about, Ray?
Which movie?
It's a Clockwork Orange.
I don't think so. I've never heard of that.
Okay, I'll briefly describe it. So the film focuses on this character named Alex, played by Malcolm McDowell, who leads a gang of ultra-violent murderers and rapists in a dystopian Britain. His gang like eventually ends up turning on him because of his arrogance, and they knock him out on a crime scene, leaving him for the police. So he's sent to prison and finds out about this science experiment that will shorten his sentence in jail if he's used as like a lab rat for this new science procedure. So the experiment that he undergoes, like it basically brainwashes him to detest violence in any situation that he's in where he sees it, and he becomes completely impotent and starts throwing up everywhere. And so after this experiment, he's released back into the world and has to deal with the repercussions to, you know, people who he's murdered and raped and stuff. And it sounds like a horrible, you know, obviously it's terrible, but that's such an interesting plot.
Definitely. Yeah,
but because he narrates the film all throughout it. So you get in the mind of his character. And one of the great things about this movie is the use of like classical music as the soundtrack. It's an excellent choice, not only for like what you're seeing with the cinematography and everything, but it also works really well with the main character, Alex. So like whenever he hears Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, it gives him this urge to like act out maniacally and you know, cause chaos. This Kubrick film, I think, has the best dialogue in all of them. Like I said, the main character narrates most of the film, and he does it in such like an eloquent and way, like refined English type way. And it contrasts well with the futuristic world that he's in. So, for example, there's this line in the movie where he's talking about, this is when he's talking about how much he likes the Beethoven symphony. It's so bizarre, but he says, "Oh, bliss, bliss in heaven. Oh, it was gorgeousness, the gorgeousity made flesh. It was like a bird of rarest spun heaven metal, or like silvery wine flowing in a spaceship. Gravity all nonsense now. As I slushied, I knew such lovely pictures." Like that is incredible to me. But you could have just done like a simple line by saying like, I really like this song. It makes me want to act out this way. But he does it in this like poetic way that's just really mesmerizing, really. But yeah, like I said, the reason I like this film so much is because in the beginning, but after he becomes victim to the psychological experiment, you begin to feel sympathy towards him. He, you know, he's weak and feels incredible remorse for his prior actions and he can't do anything about it. You know, to me, the plot of the villain feeling sorrowful for his actions seems, you know, really sappy and played, but it's done in such a hyper violent and artistic way that I really love it. And that's really all I have to say about that, unless you guys have comments.
I think that, and you mentioned Malcolm McDowell, of course, as Alex, and I think his performance, again, talking about acting, but that's the things I notice in movies, I guess, whenever a performance stands out. But Malcolm McDowell, I feel like his performance, I think, is a little underrated. He's so good. He's, like, scary good.
Yeah, yeah, that's I had that in here in my notes as well. He's a phenomenal actor, and this movie kind of ruined his reputation afterwards because dumb audiences thought that he actually was, like, a rapist, and he's not by any means. The only movie I can really think of he's also been in was he was in Star Trek Generations as the villain, and he was great. And that dialogue he had with Patrick Stewart as Picard was just fantastic. But yeah,
okay,
that's a good movie too. You should check that out. But that's all I have to say about that one. You may go on to the next one, unless Tyler or Ray has anything to say. I don't want to leave you guys out.
I haven't seen it, so obviously can't say much. But what you said, it sounds really interesting. It sounds very original.
Yeah, yeah. I've tried reading the book. The book's really hard to read. It's a lot different than the movie, but. Yeah, I fully recommend it. It's a great experience. I would probably watch it alone. You know, there's a lot of really graphic scenes in it, but
okay.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
So number seven, I have The Godfather, directed by Francis Ford Coppola and written by Mario Puzo.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie would have been higher on my list, but after I was narrowing the list down and how this movie is regarded by most as the greatest movie of all time, I kind of felt it necessary to put here. I love the movie. It's great. I recently just rewatched it. I don't really know what to say about this film that already hasn't been said. I mean, it's certainly the best mob movie to date, I think. Really only rivaled by Scorsese's Goodfellas or the television series The Sopranos. Coppola is one of my favorite directors. He comes from that last great batch of film students along with, you know, Kubrick and George Lucas, Spielberg, those guys. And the impact this movie has had on the film market industry is just truly remarkable. I would argue that this film is really when people started looking at cinema as an art film. I mean, they had before, but I think when like major audiences started realizing like, oh, well, you know, there's really something here. It started the greatest decade of filmmaking. I think the 70s really is the best decade of film. And I think that really started things off on such a high note. I mean, every single line in the movie is delivered with passion and love for the story, given that it's just so mesmerizing with like Marlon Brando and Al Pacino. I mean, those are two of like the greatest actors ever to do it. And this is what really kind of made them blow up. And really the only thing I can say that I don't like about the movie are the scenes in Italy. You know, they're kind of boring, but they do service the story as a whole. So it's all right. But the main takeaway from this movie that I love so much is that the plot of Al Pacino's character as like a character who's falling from grace to enter into the mafia style, because he's a soldier, I think, at the beginning of the movie, and he's separated from the whole mafia thing, but ends up getting pulled in when Marlon Brando gets injured and is in the hospital. And that character arc is always very appealing to me, and it's really just done masterfully. So that's all I have to say about that.
This is the first one on your list so far that I haven't seen. Which
you've
is
not
crazy
seen The Godfather?
No, I've really? Never seen it. I know. There's,
you know,
there's
Luke,
some, I know.
You
I really
guys
need
can't
to see
be
it,
mad at Luke because I haven't either.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I know that The Godfather is like one of the more praised movies of all time. Like, it's on most people's top 10 lists, but I like just have never really been like interested in the whole mob thing.
Okay, I mean, really? Fair enough.
My big worry is I'm afraid I'm going to go in there with too much hype on it, and I'm going to be disappointed.
I don't think you will, though. I don't think you can go into that movie too hype.
Yeah, when you think about it and the time that it was made, and I think 1972, that helps put you more into perspective of to what they could do in film and how it's written and everything. It's a gorgeous looking film too. The lighting is, I don't really comment on lighting that much in movies, but the lighting is so perfect in that movie because there's a lot of shadows in it. All the scenes in Marlon Brando's office as Don Corleone are man, they look so good, and it just sets the mood perfectly.
So my number six pick on the list is Fire Walk With Me.
Oh my god,
David Lynch. Yes. Oh, you like that movie?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Oh, dude, it's. I can't believe I've met someone else who likes Twin Peaks. like around here. Yeah.
I was going to ask because, like, I've always seen it as, like, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. So when you first said that, I was like, what are you talking about? But then when you brought up Twin Peaks, okay, I remember now.
It's not, it's not called Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, is it? It's just called Fire Walk With Me, right?
I thought it was called. I don't know. I thought it was, but it might not be.
I don't think it is.
I think maybe listed it might say Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, but in the title screen in the movie it just says Fire Walk With Me. But yeah, directed by David Lynch and written by David Lynch and Robert Ingalls. It's the prequel to the television series Twin Peaks, which is my all-time favorite TV show.
It's so good. It's
so good. Yeah. It's so, like, it's meta, it's everything that I like in a TV series. The first season and about halfway into the second season when they solve the murder mystery is just some of the best I've television I've ever seen.
Yeah. Now, Dylan, do you like the resolution of the murder?
Yeah, that happens like right at the beginning of season two. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yes, and especially after watching this movie, I liked it much more. Gotcha. I was not expecting that guy to be the killer. I don't want to spoil it for you guys.
I don't either.
Because it's such a great twist, I think.
Luke and Ray, have you seen Twin Peaks?
I watched the first season like a year ago, and I always meant to watch the second season. Okay. And I just haven't, I guess.
Luke,
I've only seen like one or two movies on Dylan's list.
Yeah, okay. It's all good. Yeah,
Ray,
it's all good.
Right. Do yourself a favor and watch Twin Peaks.
It is really good, man. I mean, it's really like binge worthy.
I'm definitely open to new TV shows right now because all I've been doing lately is rewatching Rick and Morty.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yes.
Yeah, that's when I watched it.
And Ray, I'll tell you, it's unlike any TV show you've ever watched.
Last year.
Have you ever seen like The Twilight Zone, Ray?
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Actually,
it is. No. Yeah. Okay, well, never mind. Do you know what The Twilight Zone is?
I have kind of an idea, maybe.
Well, it's kind of similar to Twilight Zone, and some of the things happen.
Is that to, like, deal with, like, paranormal stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, since Ray hasn't seen it, I'll kind of briefly talk about the synopsis. I guess, like, in a synopsis of the story of Twin Peaks, I'll tell you, because I really want you to watch it, Ray. It's really good.
So this is for the show?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, this is for the show. Yeah. This is for the show. Okay. The movie acts as, like, that I'm talking about, acts as a prequel to the TV show. But in a brief synopsis, the show is about this high school girl that washes up dead, wrapped in plastic, on the shore of this town called Twin Peaks. And the FBI comes in to investigate it. Like Luke said, Kyle MacLachlan, he's the main character. He plays Dale Cooper as the FBI agent investigating the case. And he finds out all this crazy stuff linked to her death and finds out that there's something weird going on in the town, like supernatural almost. So yeah, the movie Fire Walk With Me is as I stated before, is a prequel to the TV show. So the main character of the film is the dead girl that washes up in the first episode. She's the main character, Laura Palmer, who is portrayed by the actress Cheryl Lee. And this is probably my favorite female portrayal in any film ever made. She gives a really convincing portrayal of the hellish and nightmare-fueled encounters she has throughout the movie. The things I remember the most about the movie were her expressions that she makes when, you know, something crazy is happening around her or something scary. And she screams a lot throughout the movie, but it's not like, it's not in an annoying way. It's just really piercing and haunting. You really feel bad for her, and she does a great job. And another great performance in the movie is the actor Ray Weiss, I think is his name. And he plays Laura's father named Leland. And Leland was my favorite character in the TV show. And this movie gives his character like way more backstory and a lot more screen time. His ability to change from crying to like maniacal laughter within one scene is just enthralling, really. One of the main reasons I put this film so high on the list was not only that, you know, it's one of my favorite TV shows, but it really separated the fans to see who was really a true fan of the series from like the hipsters who think the show is just this quirky TV show about coffee and stuff like that. The film is really dark compared to the TV show. And it's appropriate given the TV show had such a menacing and evil undertone to its story. The film ties perfectly into the series as well as the Return series, which came out 2 years ago. It's technically season 3, which is also, I mean, just as good. But that's really all I have to say about that. Number 5, I have Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, directed by Mel Stewart.
Oh, that is awesome. That's a great choice.
Hold up. The Gene Wilder version, right?
Yes, yeah. The remake is called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
So this is the original with Gene Wilder. It may seem odd or out of place that I would choose this movie this high on the list, but I just recently rewatched it on Netflix a couple days ago, and I forgot like how incredibly fond I was of this movie as a kid. You know, it's one of the first movies I ever really remember seeing in my youth, and it still has the effect on me that it did way back then. And it's funny too, because like I absolutely hate musicals, like with a passion. I hate them. I hate musical plays. I hate musical movies. I don't like them. But I cannot deny just the genius writing and the songs in this movie. They're incredible. I think Pure Imagination is one of the greatest songs ever made in film. And you know, while it primarily appeals to children, the movie has very subtle and satirical humor really sprinkled throughout it. From, you know, I'm 21 years old now, so when I rewatched it, I found myself laughing a lot through it. Much of it comes from Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka. He has such a sarcastic way of talking to the parents and the kids. There's a particular scene when like the spoiled kid Veruca Salt is like, "Snozzberries? Who ever heard of Snozzberries?" And which Willy Wonka replies, "We are the music makers and we are the dreamers of dreams." He's basically telling her to shut up in like such a funny way. I love that scene, man. It's one of Gene Wilder's best roles, I think. The film has what most modern kids movies don't have, I think, and that's heart. There's no like preaching or muddled messaging. The theme of the movie is essentially being honest and well-behaved. You'll be rewarded for that. And that may seem like really, you know, overdone or played, but it's done in this movie in such a creative and imaginary way with a chocolate factory of all things. You know, each room is designed to test the children's wants and desires. And it conveys, you know, also a criticism of like bad parenting, watching too much TV, overeating and self-indulgence. There's a lot packed into this movie that not only kids can pick up on, but also adults and parents. But the director, I didn't know this before, was primarily known for doing documentaries before this movie.
No, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, and you can, now that I know that, you can really see that, especially like the earlier scenes in the movie when it shows each kid getting the golden ticket. It's done in like almost a direct documentary style way. I think every character in the film is perfectly written, but you know, obviously Gene Wilder really steals the movie when he appears as Willy Wonka. I read that he was going to refuse the role unless the director agreed to allow him to fall and then somersault when we were introduced to him on the red carpet of the factory. Do you guys remember that scene?
Yeah.
So I guess that wasn't originally written in the script, and the director didn't want him to do that, but he's like, "All right, I'm not going to do it then." And he's like, "All right, well, you're the best at it, so go ahead." So I love that scene, and he described why he wanted to do that, to show the unreliability of Willy Wonka and whether or not he was telling the truth or not, because he constantly is like confusing the kids all the time to see who's the best of all of them. But like I said, my favorite scenes and all. My favorite scene, it scared me a lot as a kid. I think I know, you guys know what scene I'm going to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But after going back and watching it, it's my favorite scene is definitely when they ride the boat in the tunnel. because it's so out of place but fits so well with the story. It Willy Wonka is portrayed as like an insane villain screaming and singing and doing all these singing about this incredibly like dark song with images of like insects and chickens getting decapitated are shown. It's really freaky for a G movie. It's rated G. I couldn't believe that when I saw the chicken get its head cut off. It's the only song that is taken directly from the book in the movie. It's really creepy. Like the not a speck of light is showing, so the danger must be growing. Are the fires of hell glowing? Is the grisly reaper mowing? I mean, that's horrifying. He's talking about hell in a kid's movie in a chocolate factory of all places. And one of the best parts in the movie, I laughed so hard at it. Like when he's doing this, it cuts to one of the kids and the little girl's like, what is this, some kind of freak out? Or something like that. It's hilarious. Yeah. So that's my number five choice. You guys can comment on that, or if you have anything to say.
I think it's an interesting choice.
Number four on my list is Taxi Driver, directed by Martin Scorsese and written by Paul Schrader. Have you guys seen this one?
I saw it for the first time like last week.
Greatest monologue ever given in film.
I know it's a classic, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I think as far as classics go, Ray, I think you would like this one more than The Godfather. I think it would.
I really agree with that one. Yeah,
I am
going to watch one off of your list probably tonight.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to decide which one.
I don't know what his top three are yet, but this would be a pretty good one.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to say. I really considered putting this movie at number one on my list, especially when I first saw this movie. I was just utterly shocked and thought I would never see another film that would make me feel that way ever again. Just even from just the beginning of the movie, I was instantly hooked. That's another thing I was going to comment on is usually I'm one of those people that if it does not hook me within the first 5 to 10 or 15 minutes, I'm checked out. Like I'm probably not going to like the movie.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there.
Yeah, the first shot of this movie, you know, with the close up of Robert De Niro's eyes flashing red from the street lights, accompanied by that like really iconic like soft jazz orchestra, I just knew that this was going to be like a masterpiece of film. Truly, that jazz score is played often throughout the movie, mostly when he's driving his cab. It's just so euphoric and sets the tone of the film so flawlessly. You know, the film's main theme obviously is coping with loneliness and existentialism, finding your identity, and I've yet to see another film deal with those issues in such a adept and artistic way, really. And I couldn't think of a better way to convey those themes than being a taxi driver in New York City. Robert De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, really puts the audience in perspective as to how awful and disgusting New York City is. I don't know about you guys personally, but I like space, so especially after watching this movie, I have no desire to go to New York City ever. I don't know about you guys, but
I've always wanted to go to New York City.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm too scared.
Luke, you go to New York fairly frequently, right?
Oh yeah, my youth group usually goes like every summer. Of course, we couldn't this year because of COVID, but we go every summer, and like I love it for the week that I'm there, but I would absolutely never want to live there.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's. Like, and the movie does a great job of you know, he's constantly commenting on how overcrowded and dirty and scummy the city is. Finding yourself, like in the theme of the movie, finding yourself in your true identity under these conditions really seems impossible. Every shot of the movie is, you never see like an open space. He's always like he's inside, or he's inside his car, or he's, you know, towered by like the buildings. There's never... It just really gives that sense of just like feeling like you can't get out, really. And I really think a big misconception this film has is with Robert De Niro's character being an evil psychopath. I mean, granted, he does try to assassinate a politician, but I would consider the character more of like an anti-hero, I guess, more at the least. You know, the people that he kills in the movie are despicable people breaking the law. And
right, yeah.
He takes justice into his own hands, as he's been conditioned to believe that the unlawfulness of New York will never end, really. I mean, he does say in the film to another cab driver, I've got a lot of bad ideas in my head, almost as like a cry for help, but he really never acts on these terrible thoughts. other than shooting, you know, the robber in the convenience store and killing a couple of pimps trying to molest an underage girl. And I mean, even that's pushing it because those people are just scum. Like I said, this is, in my opinion, Scorsese's best film. I know he said before that he intentionally made the narrative flow of this film in an almost dreamlike fashion, which is like a state of mind that he feels when he watches really good movies. And I think this concept can be really perplexing to an audience if they don't understand exactly what that means. So as with many films that use this dreamlike narrative, certain events will occur that make the audience believe by the end of the film that everything they have just witnessed was all in the protagonist's head. So movies like American Psycho, Joker, The Lighthouse, those are ones that come to mind when I think of this issue. And while that may seem like a cool concept in your mind as a means of connecting the scenes together, it completely makes the experience of watching a movie worthless, I think. Movies should act as a brief escape from reality and the mysticism and fantasy of hyper-exaggerated nature of film is what draws us back to movies. So by saying, you know, all of Taxi Driver was totally imagined in Robert De Niro's mind, I think you've just openly admitted that you've wasted 2 hours of your life, and at that point movie watching becomes pointless to me. I don't know what you guys think about that, but I really hate that trope of at the end of the movie they're like, oh well, it's all in the protagonist's head. I took a screenwriting class at that film camp, and that was like the big no-no that they said that's the most amateur thing you can do as a writer. But
yeah, that trope, it can solely ruin a movie for me if a movie uses that trope.
Yes. Like,
that's the most shoe-in trope you can possibly use.
Yeah. The thing I hate the most is that Looper YouTube channel. If you look at any movie that comes out, they'll have a video that'll be like, the ending of Joker explained. And like the first thing that they say, it was all in his head. Like that is such a terrible, terrible analysis. I hate that so much because talking about Taxi Driver, I mean, Martin Scorsese has proved to be one of like the great filmmakers. And I really don't think he would make a film to where nothing happens in it. That just seems like, you know, he gets caught up in the art of it and wanting to actually tell a story. So
yeah.
My third one, and I know Tyler really likes this movie, is Blade Runner Final Cut, the original first movie.
Oh, great movie. One of the best sci-fi movies ever made.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah, and I'm going to talk about that. Yeah. This is directed by Ridley Scott and written by Hampton Fancher and David Peoples. The first time I saw this movie, I saw it in I don't think it was IMAX, but it kind of reminded me of it. It was this old theater it was when I was in Seattle at art school. My friends and I all went to go see it. It was called the Cinerama.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
Dude, I can't even describe to you that is the best movie experience I've ever had in theaters because I had no idea, you know, I knew that Harrison Ford was in it and I knew it was sci-fi, but I had no idea what the movie was about, and everyone there I had already seen it, so I felt a little out of place, but man, once it started, I mean, the screen was massive that I saw it on, and the sound, the speakers they used were, I can't remember exactly what they were, but they kept making a big deal out of them. And they sounded so good, man. I mean, when he fires his gun, when Harrison Ford fires his gun at the replicant running through the glass, I mean, that gunshot was so like meaty and loud. And it just like vibrated throughout my body, dude. It was so effective. And it just really was like the best film experience I've ever had in theaters. You know, the plot is extremely simple. Harrison Ford is this thing called a Blade Runner who is tasked to hunt down these replicants pretending to be humans that have stolen a ship from Mars and, you know, want to seek the creator of the androids to give them more life. And this movie, I think, was really when I started thinking about that, plots in movies. Really, all the movies that I like that are on this list have very simple plots, but they expand in other areas of the film, like the exterior of the film. They really like fluff those areas up and make it more appealing rather than a really convoluted plot or story. I find a hard time liking those types of movies, but there's really never a time that I don't feel like watching this movie. I've seen it probably more than any other movie I've watched. It's really get lost in this world of cyberpunk LA. I think it was one of the first things that kind of invented that genre, that cyberpunk genre.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I know. Like in the prequels too, the Star Wars prequels, Coruscant was heavily based off of this movie, and you can actually see the Blade Runner car fly by in one of the scenes, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
Like Tyler said, yeah, this is my favorite sci-fi movie ever. I think the themes are great. Harrison Ford actually does a good job acting in this movie. He's someone that I really don't like as acting that well, other than like Han Solo and Indiana Jones, obviously. But this one, he actually looked like he liked what he was doing in this movie. If you get what I'm saying, I feel like sometimes he's in movies and he's just like kind of there.
I definitely get what you're saying.
Oh yeah,
that's how he was later on in his career in Star Wars. I feel like he didn't really want to be there at all.
Yeah. So it was like refreshing to see that, where he's like, you know, he seems like he's caring what he's doing. And man, the soundtrack in this movie is the best soundtrack I've ever heard in any movie. I mean, it's like pure bliss. This movie would be great without the soundtrack, but the soundtrack is really just like the cherry on top, man. It really like immerses you into that world. The crazy, like heavy attacking synths and stuff, like synthesizers. It's great. Ridley Scott's directing, he's obviously one of my favorites. He did Alien. He did Blade Runner. I enjoyed Prometheus. I know a lot of people didn't. I enjoyed
Prometheus too.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's okay.
Yeah, a lot of the problems with Prometheus really relied on the studio director clashing together, which you see that a lot in the modern film industry now. I really think if they let him have total control over it, it would have been way better. And you know, he did Gladiator. I love Gladiator. And he also did Alien Covenant, which that movie just sucks. I think that's one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. It really,
honestly, it's just a mess. Not holding back.
I don't think it's that bad, honestly.
Yeah, me and Tyler either. Saw that in theaters, and I liked it. I thought it was pretty
cool. Really?
Now, Dylan, here's the thing, though. Like, Covenant is the only of the Alien movies I've seen. So I don't have anything.
Oh my. You haven't seen the original Alien?
You haven't seen the original?
I've seen like the first 20 minutes of it.
I love that movie.
And then it just kind of lost me in it. It's one of those things that's like, it's definitely on my list to view, like to actually sit down and watch. But as of right now, Covenant is the only one I've seen.
Oh man. I think your opinion would change if you saw the original.
I'm sure it would.
Yeah, I just did not. That's a topic for another time. I'm a huge Alien fan. I love Ridley Scott. And, you know, I was going to talk about this when I was talking about filmmaking. I watched an interview with Billy Corgan, who's the lead singer of Smashing Pumpkins, the band. Yeah. And he said something that I think also applies to film. He said that once you start making music, it kind of ruins the experience a little bit of listening to music. And I kind of feel that way with directing, because now that I know how movies are made behind the scenes and I read these articles and news stories, you know, what was happening behind the scenes, it really makes me hate those movies. Like there is a lot of problems with this movie behind the sets, and all of it involves 20th Century Fox, which is probably why I hate it. You know, I don't like any of the new Star Wars movies. Like I said,
Did you listen to our Last Jedi episode?
Yes. Yeah. I listened to it. Well, Ray brought up a lot of great points though. I thought he
was very convincing. Thank you, Dylan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You did. Yeah. You
I've actually convinced a lot of people who hate that movie to actually end up liking it.
Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah.
Not Tyler. I've tried multiple times.
I even convinced Luke it was worse.
I mean, I know that's a little off topic for me, but reading the behind the scenes of what happened with Rian Johnson and stuff was what really made me hate it. But,
right. It's so bad.
Yeah,
it's such a disaster of behind the scenes, like studio interference.
Yes, Disney is the most evil, I think, corporation. That's just my opinion. I think that they really take advantage of directors and writers and actors, and
they're very money hungry.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. they're really teetering the edge of becoming a monopoly. I mean, I really think they are one, but Blade Runner is really, like I said, it's the perfect film of having a very basic plot, but exploring and like finessing other parts of the film and making it more unique and enjoyable. Like the cinematography and the massive set design and really clever camera tricks. Like this movie, the scope of this movie and world building within, you know, the 2 hours or so that it goes on is remarkable. I mean, Star Wars kind of does that over several movies, but this is really only at the time it was only limited to just one movie. And the set design, man, I mean, it's just massive. It's truly, that's what I love about Ridley Scott's movies is he tends to not rely on CGI and rely on real physical objects and, you know, paintings and stuff like that. But I know Tyler may have read about this, but do you know the camera trick they use to get the orange reflection on the eyes of the replicants? Have you read about that?
I haven't heard about it.
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so they did this by using this photographer's name, Fritz Lang is his name.
Oh, he has this thing. Yeah, Metropolis.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He has this thing called the Shofton process. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And it's where light is reflected into the actor's eyes from a piece of half-mirrored glass mounted at like a 45-degree angle on the camera.
That's pretty cool.
Because the creativity in the making of this movie is so unique, because this could have easily been done today in post-production with CGI, and you would have never thought of anything of it. But the fact that they had to, you know, limited the time they had and where they were, you know, they had to do it that way. It just shows how much he really cared about getting this movie out there. Yeah, like I said, you know, I've already talked about how good the score is. But the thing, as I've watched it multiple times again, the best thing that I keep coming back to this movie is Rutger Hauer's performance. He plays, I know he passed away last year, sadly, but his performance in the movie is just absolutely, I don't know, I mean, just insane. I mean, really, it's insane how good it is, because I didn't know who he was as an actor, you know, because he's portrayed as like the villain all throughout the movie, but really he's not. He's not really a bad guy. At the end, you realize that he's not. And man, the ending scene of Blade Runner is that scene. I think you know what I'm talking about, this scene like with in the rain.
In rain monologue?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Great. Yeah. Dude, that I was reading about that, and he improvised that, and like people were like crying on set because of how like beautiful it was, and like Ridley Scott was blown away by it. And it's truly just one of it's the greatest exit monologue of a character, and it's done in this like almost like Greek fairy tale type fashion, and it's truly great. The song that plays is great by Vangelis at that time. You know, Harrison Ford doesn't really say anything; he's just in awe of what he's saying. Rutger Hauer's character is saying. Now I'm gonna say this, and you guys are probably going to hate me for saying this, but like I said, his performance was improvised in that part where his character dies at the end. I read in Infinity War that Tom Holland did the same thing when he, you know, when he dies. Have you guys read that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talked about that in our last episode.
Okay. I think there is a stark contrast between both. When I saw that, I just thought nothing of it, of the Spider-Man thing. I don't really like that guy as Spider-Man. I think Rutger Hauer is a more experienced and better actor, and his performance in that, and you know, comparing exit monologues was more believable, because you never really thought there was going to be a sequel to Blade Runner. When I saw Spider-Man dying in Infinity War, I knew that he'd only been in like one or two movies. I knew that they signed like 4 or 5 movie year contracts or whatever. I knew he was going to return.
That was what my argument was.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. I guess I can spoil it now since it's going to release before this episode comes out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, I did end up winning, and that was one of my, like, main points for the, I guess, what was that, my writing round argument or directing?
That would have been acting.
Acting, yeah. Which, yeah, I think
that was Luke's. That was Luke's argument, and then I, like, countered it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
with
that.
What Dylan just said.
Yeah, I think that that scene in Infinity War would have been more effective if the original cast faded away rather than like some of the new characters, because it doesn't make sense from the, you know, a business standpoint from you know that that Black Panther and Spider-Man really only had like one movie. You know that they're going to make more of those because they make millions of dollars. But that's another topic. But yeah, I really think that Blade Runner is just a great sci-fi epic based on, I know it's based on a lot of like Greek Greek storytelling and stuff like that. And it really shows the architecture of like the Tyrell Corporation building and everything. It's everything that I want in a sci-fi film, and everything is executed perfectly. My number two choice was The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin and written by William Peter Blatty. Okay. I'm sure you guys have heard of this film, right?
It's a great
film. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen it?
I've seen it.
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Okay. All right. A lot of the movies I've chosen on this list, I don't know if you guys may have picked up on it, were books before they were movies.
Yes.
I haven't read all of the books on this list, but I did read this book after watching the movie. And the book is... I just didn't think that I could read something and it would give me chills while I was reading it. It just scared the hell out of me, really. There are certain scenes that they had to shorten from the book because it is a movie. And it is pretty long. I mean, I think it's like almost 2.5 hours, I think. But there is one part in particular in the book that I really wish they kept in the film because it was so just haunting, really.
And what's that?
Okay, if you're familiar with the movie, it's right when her mom thinks that there's something wrong with her. She has all these tests done in a neurologist's office. Basically, she has this operation done, and it's a really gross scene. Especially the infamous scene is where the needle goes in her neck, and it looks really real.
Yeah.
Apparently, like a lot of people fainted from that scene when it came out in theaters. But when she comes back from the hospital and she's all like kind of drugged out from it, it's really when she starts becoming possessed. She's sitting on this chair in the living room, and this doctor keeps asking her questions, and I she kills the doctor, I remember, in the movie. She does in the book as well, but the book, between the dialogue between the doctor and the child, the little girl, is way scarier. It's very brief in the movie, but so basically she's speaking another language, they think, and they can't understand what she's saying. And when I was reading it, I couldn't understand it either. I thought it was another language, but after like the chapter ends, she was saying "I am no one" backwards, and that, when I read that, man, I like my jaw dropped when I was reading that. I was like, that is so scary. That, I mean, really freaked me out when I read that. I had goosebumps. I mean, I recommend the book a lot. It's a lot more graphic and a lot, more vulgar, but it's great. So I'm sure you guys know what the plot of the movie is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I did a lot of research on this project for my senior year of high school. We had a project on, it could be about anything or something like that.
Dylan.
I mean, yeah.
You went to a Catholic high school, right?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And you did a project on The Exorcist?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'll just say that the school I went to, man, I mean, really anything went, honestly. Like,
okay. Same.
They didn't really care, man. They, you know, and the project was, you could do it on anything, and it was for a history class. So, I mean, that was just really vague. So I just decided to research this movie because I watched it. It was around Halloween, and I rewatched it again, and it's amazing, the everything that happened in this movie while they were filming it. It's incredible that it was even made. So I probably know more about this movie than anything I've ever seen. Have you guys heard that apparently the filming was cursed?
Yes.
Movie? Okay, so the film was based on a real event of a little boy who was possessed by a demon, and Georgetown Jesuit priest performed an exorcism in the hospital. And the boy ripped off his restraints and ripped out box springs out of the bed and slashed one of the priest's wrist with it and severely injured him. Apparently, you know, I guess they did exorcise the demon out of him. But when the guy was writing the book, he decided to, the family of the little boy asked to change the gender of the person possessed. So they changed it to a girl for the movie. But I think this is the scariest thing that I've read about this movie. Was the house that, you know, most of the movie takes place in caught fire randomly. Oh. I don't know how. It delayed shooting a long time. But the creepiest thing about it is, you know, the entire house caught fire, but the only room that was not affected by it was the bedroom that the exorcism takes place in.
No.
So,
no.
Yeah, man.
I don't know if, like, I don't know if I have talked about this on the show or not, but, like, I don't believe in ghosts or the paranormal or anything. But despite that, I will not mess with anything occult. I don't.
Oh, yeah.
I don't.
Also, in the movie, two of the actors in it that died in the movie actually died in post-production of the film in real life, which that's so bizarre to me because I'm pretty sure these actors were fairly young when that happened. And the iconic voice of the demon was this older lady named Mercedes Cambridge. And apparently her son murdered his wife and children before killing himself.
Oh, gosh.
Short after the movie came out. Like, dude, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that happened in this movie. I have a book on it, actually, written by the director, William Friedkin, that I read. It came with the Blu-ray. It's really interesting. But one more thing. When the movie premiered in Rome, audiences had to, like, basically fight their way in this torrential downpour on the way to the theater, you know, and they're storming like crazy, thunder, lightning, and all that, just to get inside the theater. And when they got inside and the movie started playing, many claimed to hear a horrific, almost demonic cry coming from outside once the film started rolling, and a bunch of people left. So, I mean, just in thinking about in the sense that this movie came out in 1973 really baffles me, because I really think this movie changed the scope of cinema forever, and no one had seen anything remotely like this movie at that time. It's groundbreaking in really every aspect. Only few horror movies have ever come close to, I think, reaching its display of horror to me, like The Shining and Hereditary are a few. I know Tyler, you mentioned Hereditary before on the podcast. Yeah, that movie literally gave me chills when I saw that in the theater. That was
the only movie to ever scare me.
Yeah, I mean that movie,
it didn't scare me.
Really?
Yeah.
Man. This movie, I think, utilizes gore and vulgarity in a way that fits the narrative of the story rather than just, you know, flat out being edgy or whatever. Like the scene where she stabs herself with the crucifix sexually and spins her head around is the most disturbing thing I've ever seen in my life. That's probably because, you know, I've been raised Catholic. That really bothered me when I saw that the first time. And the fact that the writer came up with that scene really makes me question his sanity. But what getting to think about it, it kind of makes sense. The little girl is claiming she is the devil, so I would only imagine the devil could do something so revolting to audiences. So,
yeah,
you know, and the movie, like I said, spawned so many ripoffs, and they fail miserably on every level, I think, because the story isn't there and neither are the characters.
What would you say the best imposter of The Exorcist is?
Well, the one that immediately comes to mind is Hereditary. I mean, it's a little different, but in the same vein, I think it was done exceptionally, because the way the movie was marketed, you really thought it was going to be about the little girl, and they kill her off in the beginning of the movie, and it focuses on the mother. Which,
yeah, I know. I was really surprised when the little girl died.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was such a unique twist.
Because she was in all the marketing. So, like, you just assumed she would be, like, the main character.
Yeah, 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 exactly. So I would say that.
Have you ever seen The Autopsy of Jane Doe?
No.
You should watch that. It's not...
Really?
It's not... It's on Netflix. It's not, you know, entirely like The Exorcist, but it's similar in, like, demonic possessions and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, like, super short, too. It's only, like, an hour and a half.
Okay. Is it a movie, or is it, like, a documentary?
No, it's a movie. It's a movie.
It's a movie? Okay.
It builds atmosphere so well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the thing that these types of movies have to have. They have to have great atmosphere.
Yeah.
Rather than relying on the jump scares.
I think a lot of it has to do with the music too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point you brought up, because this movie doesn't use a lot of music in it. It's more, the camera will just focus on the horror being displayed, and it just forces you to look at it. And there really isn't a lot of music in it other than, like, the iconic theme song. But Yeah, I agree. Music can really stir those emotions up, like The Shining does that like exceptionally well, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's the one thing I remember from The Shining the most.
I remember the first time I watched that movie, I got to see it
in theaters, actually.
Oh yeah, we did. It was so good.
Dude, I would die to see that.
It was awesome.
The first time I watched that movie, The Shining, I was at my friend's house, and it was really late, so I fell asleep during it the first time I saw it. And I woke up right at the scene when it's like towards the end of the movie where Shelley Duvall's character has the knife going up the stairs and there's like the chanting music and she turns right and there's the bear scene, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And the bed. That's Jack Nicholson's one of my favorite actors ever. He does that so well. He's like the actor, when I think of an actor that displays like anger and like rage filled insanity, I always think of him. He does it so well. It's so believable. But yeah, like I said, you know, the characters in the movie. Yeah, the main character that I like in the movie so much is the young priest, Father Karras. He's played by this actor named Jason Miller, who really wasn't in a lot of movies other than this. This is his probably most famous role. He was in some football movie too, I think. The director of this movie saw a play, and he just liked the way that he looked and asked him to do the part, and he ended up doing an incredible job just based on the way he looked. I like the way the movie follows him as a young priest beginning to like doubt his faith as he watches his terminally ill mother suffer and eventually die. That's a really interesting character arc, I think, and they play on that later in the movie. He's also well versed in psychology, and you know, upon the pleading of the little girl's mother to perform an exorcism, he's extremely skeptical and thinks the girl is suffering from schizophrenia. The devil or possessed little girl in the movie uses this to toy with his mind. Have you guys ever seen when he first walks in the room and interviews her? Have you guys ever seen that scene?
Yeah.
So the scene is perfect because the camera follows the door slowly opening to view her like tied to the bed, and she just looks like the devil. I mean, she's all like beat up, her face is green, you know, her eyes are all messed up, she's got vomit on her gown, and the camera just forces you to look at it, so it's like it's putting it in perspective of what he sees. So the scene already starts off great by then. But, you know, he's asking her questions and stuff, and he asks who she is. And the girl's voice changes. It's not the little girl's voice anymore. It's this, like, really guttural, deep, almost like smoker voice. It sounds like it's an old woman who voices it, but it's so scary. Her voice is so, like, chilling, and it matches her lips really well. He asks who she is, and she says, she's like, well, I'm the devil. He asks her, he's like, the little girl's name is Reagan, and he asks her, he said, well, where's Reagan? And she just chillingly says, she's in here with us. And it's just, it's so chilling, because he's starting to... He's still doubting, and he thinks that she's schizophrenic, even though she looks like a mess. But the moment he realizes that there's something going on is you hear this line. He turns around, and you hear this line. It's this old guy that says, could you help an old altar boy, father? And that's a line that a beggar asked the priest earlier in the movie. So there's no way that she knew that happened. So he turns around, and he's really frightened by that. And he walks over to her again, and he says, or the little girl says, your mother is in here with this, Karras. Would you like to leave a message? And at that point, he realizes that there's something like seriously wrong going on, because there's no way she would have known. She doesn't know who he is, and she never would have known that his mother passed away. So it's a really... And then she vomits on him, of course, because he asks her what her maiden name is, and she throws up on him. They use like pea soup, I think, for the vomit. Yeah, man, it's really, you should definitely go back and watch it. It's a really horrific movie, and like I said, the characters are great. My number one movie on my list is Apocalypse Now, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Great.
Before I watched this movie, for some reason, I depicted it as this like nonstop action thrill ride of the Vietnam War. And I really don't think I've been so wrong in my life. I mean, the film is told in such a hypnotic and surreal way that just really shows the horror of war along with its psychological effects. And I really think it's the most accurate depiction of war I've ever seen, and certainly the most effective anti-war message. Just a few really interesting facts that I read about this movie. Coppola invested $7 million of his own money into the film after it went over budget. And he even mortgaged his own house to complete the film.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, I mean, talk about dedication. I mean, he really wanted to make this movie and make sure it got done. It's based on a book called Heart of Darkness, which was written in like the late 1800s. So it's not about the Vietnam War, but they incorporated the Vietnam War to its story. Some other things I read, Coppola threatened to kill himself multiple times while filming this from all the problems that went on. Marlon Brando, who I think is one of the greatest actors ever, was so difficult to work with that the assistant director directed all the scenes with him because Coppola and him did not get along when they filmed that movie. Brando gained a lot of weight before the movie, and his character that he plays, General Kurtz, is supposed to be this like really tall, 6'5", like scary figure. So all the scenes with Brando in it are just close-ups of his face, really. They had a stand-in actor do the scenes where he's standing.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's interesting. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, the lead character, Willard, who's played by Martin Sheen, he had a heart attack while filming. So his brother came in and filled in for a lot of the scenes as like a stunt double. And he also did a lot of the narration, too. His brother did, which I thought was really interesting. But the most interesting thing that I read about this was George Lucas was originally planned to be the director of this film. But due to, filming restraints for making Star Wars, he was unable to. So I just can't even imagine this movie directed by George Lucas, this rated R, hyper-violent film directed by George Lucas. But he's friends with Coppola, and he was the one who told the studio to get Coppola to make the movie. But the famous napalm scene where they blow up the forest.
Right.
Yeah.
Apparently, the editing for that took 1 year to complete, just that sequence, which I thought was crazy because it says right here, approximately 10% of the entire film's footage shot was from that sequence, which is crazy because that scene's so short. But it's real, so I thought that was really interesting. The iconic opening scene of the palm tree is burning, and there's like the faded image of Willard's face. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So they used 1,200 gallons of gasoline were poured over the palm trees and then set on fire, and they set a bunch of tires on fire to create more smoke for the shot. While canisters were dropped into the area, making it look like napalm. But acres of the forest were actually destroyed while filming the movie. It was filmed in the Philippines, which was, while they were filming it, was in the midst of their own war with rebels. So environmental issues were not a big priority, apparently. So I can't even imagine, like, with all the environmental stuff now, actually burning a forest down for a brief shot in the opening of your movie. But yeah, this movie seemed impossible to make at the time. But a lot of movies at this time, I think, that have those stories of troubleshooting, like this movie, Exorcist, Jaws, Star Wars, they all turned out to be masterpieces. The directors associated with these movies were so determined to see a physical manifestation of their story by whatever means necessary. I mean, he sold his house and sunk $7 million of his own money he wanted to see it that bad. They didn't bow down to production companies like you see today. Like I said, I think the biggest, the most infamous of this problem would be Disney Star Wars. It's just another topic. I could talk about that forever. Suicide Squad is another one. That's another great debacle between studio and director. Every director of these movies had such a unique style to their films. So to me, most movies have the same feel to them. Not all, but most. I think writers and directors today lack the integrity and heart that it takes to see their vision come true. Now, I know that's not true for everything. There are some great movies that have come out in our time, but as a majority, I think it really that that happens. But the plot's really simple in a brief sense. His dad, Martin Sheen, plays a character called Willard, who's this someone who hates war but feels empty without it. Is called back to Vietnam for service for the secret mission to hunt down or capture Marlon Brando's character, General Kurtz, who's just gone absolutely insane, killing his own men and just wiping out entire villages of people and making himself like a cult leader. But all this is happening during the Vietnam War, so there's a lot of great, you know, battle scenes that they end up getting dragged into. And most of the movie takes place actually with them on the boat trying to get to Cambodia to get to Marlon Brando's, where he's at, his cult is at. But yeah, I think it's the greatest war movie ever, and that's really all I have to say about it.